Yo, check this out. This is Fresh Fit Out the China Man with the 2 Live Crew.
Yo, what's up, y'all? It's me, DMC.
What's up, y'all? This is the Blunt Master P.
Yo, check us out. Chuck the Public Enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yella from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DLC.
This is your boy, C-Murder.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfuckers.
This is your boy, DJ Paul KOL 365.
Young Dizzy Paul.
Vice One.
Yo, this is DJ Reddy Red.
What up? This is the real Rick Ross. You listen to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
This is a show that shows no limits, broadcast nothing but the real. Interviews with legendary artists, still got love for the underground feel. Rappers with records, reveal the addition of rappers that are coming up, get them put on. We get to the platform to fight the mainstream. This is the show that you need to be on. Hit up UGS for life on screen and follow with Wizard.com. For all of your needs, production and mixing and mastering, graphics and shadow design. Check out the archives and touch with the shows. Plenty of content for you to get through. Everything free to download and stream. Oh yeah, we deserve the real.
Love to all your fans, motherfuckers wanna hate. Do your thing, you keep the focus, bringing nothing but the rigor. Come and tune into the dopest.
I'm a man-made guy, crazy, knocking all you rappers off. It's underground society, it's serious for life, dog. Hip hop, AD, represent for the legends. Rapping mumble rappers, so we sitting on the hip. Two pocket beats, dreaming, thank you for the bliss. It's a murder master music show. Free the homie gangster, bro. I see these rappers on the streets, I got my chop up.
Yeah, what's up, everybody? It's your boy Prez. Welcome to the Murder Master Music Show. This is episode 675. We got a special guest tonight, and you know, it's always about the music, but we also like to go into other forms of entertainment as well. Matter of fact, our guest tonight, he's a multifaceted entertainer. I'm talking about the sports world as well as the music world. I'm talking about former basketball great, one and only Terry Cummings. Let me bring him on right now. Terry, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself, Scott?
I'm doing real good, and thank you for taking the time out to speak with us today. I know you got a lot of things going, but for our fans listening, most of them, you know, they remember you from the NBA. You had almost a 20-year career, considered one of the top 50 scorers of all time. You know, you played with the greats. But before we get into your history, I want to take time to reflect on somebody you played with for a long time as well, the late Kobe Bryant. That's most tragic news any of us could hear, whether you're a fan or someone like yourself that knew him. Can you take time out to reflect on the Kobe that you knew?
I think we all have, I think, in this period of time. I think truly one of the things that will come out of an untimely death along these lines, at least from our perspective as human beings, is that we become very clear as to our own mortality, because then we realize that no matter how great we have been in life on earth, we are all subject to the same thing when it comes to death. And it doesn't matter how you die, just, you know, in the end you will. And I think with Kobe, from the perspective of a player and a person, you know, I always thought of Kobe as the kind of guy, the Michael Jordan, the Julius Irving, the Kareems, the Birds, you know, the kind of people that push everybody else to always play at peak and to be the best that they can be. Because if you step on that court any other way, you know, it's going to show up blaringly. But I've always admired who he was. And the push he had and the will he had to do it at all costs, no matter how much flack he got for saying or doing or being who he is.
Yeah, definitely. And, rest in peace also to everybody else perished on that horrible accident, and as well as his daughter, Gigi.
Mm-hmm.
She was obviously on her way to being a basketball great as well. When you went to the games and you came across, you know, Kobe and stuff like that, did you get to see him at all with his kids And if so, man, what was he like around his kids and his family?
No, I didn't. I actually got to see more of that in his retirement than I did, but I think that's probably more accurate for those of us who grew up at a time when our children were not in the spotlight as much as a lot of these athletes and entertainers do with their children today. And I thought that because Kobe was raised with us, older cats, that initially while he was playing, he took that same perspective. You know, you didn't see as much of the kids until I think I seen more of them in his retirement than I did in his playing days. So, but from what I understand, the visuals and the audios that are being put out on him now shows him as, you know, a really good father, you know, a really good husband. None of us are perfect. We all have something that we can go back over and say, well, you know, I didn't do that as well. I didn't handle that as well. But I don't think that's neither here nor there. The fact of the matter is your children, you know, they're the fruit of your true life, you know, and that is the piece and the part that when you look back over your life, you just want to know that you haven't failed them. And I don't think he did. I mean, I think he was the best parent he could be for his children, and it reflects in the way that things are being shown now. You're not hearing negative things, because if anyone would know, the wife would know, or people close to him, and all of them, in spite of the death, are speaking well of, you know, the things that he did, his attributes as a parent.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you know, he set the bar high, you know, for parents all over the world, you know. That's the thing. As popular as he was, I mean, he couldn't walk anywhere, go anywhere. Yet alone, he did do exactly just that. You know, go to his kids' games, wherever it was, you know. People like him are so rare. They only come along so often.
Yeah, and you just learn to appreciate, you know, the fact that you really won't run into guys like him and the Jordans and Birds and all of those guys too often, but you will find it a privilege to have played against them or played with them in your career, because it does enhance everything, you know, around you. Because, you know, when you step on the floor, you know, with those types of players, that your game has to respond. You know, you have to respond. So I agree with you, you know, 100% on that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're from Chicago, you know, the good old Windy City. I grew up in Berwyn and Cicero, so I'm not too far from where you grew up from.
Right.
You know, what was it like growing up in the city of Chicago, and at what age did you develop your love for the game of basketball?
Well, you know, going back for the All-Star weekend reminded me what it was like growing up in Chicago. It was cold. And it was very different because I haven't been to Chicago like that in years. I mean, where the weather was cold like that. I mean, going through it, every layers and everything. But initially for me, Chicago, as far as sports were concerned, was hockey and baseball for me. And then I just, from my freshman to sophomore year, I grew about 8 inches over the summer from about 5'8 to 6'4. Which changed everything. You know, I still played baseball even through my pro career. I would play in weekend tournaments. But basketball became a love when I began to follow after my brother Lee, who was a tremendous player. And I just followed in his footsteps, wanted to be like him. And eventually what happened for me was I found my own path and my own journey with the game, playing all over the city. You know, CYC, playing in the youth center leagues, the Park District leagues, Boys Girls Clubs of America. You know, just finding wherever we could find talent, we would travel to it, you know, to play the best players around the city, play at the colleges. We played against Illinois State, Chicago State. You know, we would get a chance to play the best players that we knew we could find in Illinois. And then the pro-am in Chicago State was probably the pinnacle of it for me, because I got to play against pros from overseas, pros from the NBA, college kids, high school kids, all this at the age of 16, 17. And this was when I really started to gain the knowledge that I knew how to play. I didn't know the fullness of the game because I only played 2 years of high school ball and three in college, but I have always been a sponge. I always learned really quickly, and I picked up the game with Horace Howard at Carver High School and then with Coach Ray Meyer at DePaul, and they gave me an opportunity and took advantage of it.
Yeah. And, you know, early on in your career, you know, a lot of people that listening right now, they might not remember, though, you were going to be you were actually going to be a Chicago Bull at one time, or at least that was on the table. What were your thoughts about possibly playing for the city you grew up in?
Oh, it would have been the max. It would have been the best for me. I always wanted to come home, and I had a couple other opportunities to come home, but they were not the kind of opportunities that, like, I would not have wanted to come home to sit behind someone that I didn't think I needed to sit behind. So I was in position to be a formidable player for the first 9-10 years, you know, on the list of power forwards, small forwards, and centers. I didn't want to come in halfway and be shabby about it. I always thought that, you know, what you do should speak for you. And if that is not enough for people, then, you know, it just ain't enough. But, you know, you go out and you work, you put in the time, you make sure that you do what you're required to do, and you be the best teammate you can be when you're doing it with team sports, and let everything else fall where it falls. You know, and when the time comes, you know, you should be celebrated for who you are and what you've done, not for a facsimile of something that is really not the real deal, you know, just something that assimilates to what everybody else is doing. I always thought my talent was different, you know, because I always thought of it in terms of being a 9-to-5 worker, you know, put on your hard hat, put on your gear, go out there and work. And it doesn't matter who you're working against, put in the same work every night. It may not give you the same production every night, but everyone will know you're out there doing your job. And that was really important to me.
Well, I tell you what, Terry, you really did your job because, you know, I believe you came up in the best era of basketball. You transcended
you and
from
me both.
One era into another. You know, from the early 80s all the way to the 90s, I mean, you had the Birds, the Magics, of course, the Jordans, Pippins. You know, you put up solid numbers against all those greats. But you yourself, you know, I feel you're one of those greats as well. Do you feel that sometimes you kind of get slept on as well as other athletes from that era because there was so much talent?
Yeah, I do. And I think that if you're not the guy that goes out and blows his own horn and puts himself out front, then you'll be put to the back. But all the guys in the front, when they look back, they have to look at you because the only way they could get where they're going is they have to go through you to get there. And so, you know, it has always been enough for me to know that I respected my own self and appreciated my own labor enough not to get myself bent out of shape because, you know, they don't put you up front. You know, there's
yeah.
a saying amongst older women in our family and older men in our family, you know, don't be axed down. You know, don't put yourself in a place where someone has to tell you to come down. You know, you just wait your opportunity, and when it comes, celebrate with those who celebrate you, and don't worry about the rest of it, because there's a lot of politics, there's a lot of other things involved in that higher echelon of stuff, but I never take a back seat to them or to the ideal or mindset of it, because I've always gone on the court. I do the same in my life now. I believe in who I am. I believe that when I do what I do, there's no one better than me. Even if they show up better on the tube or on the court, I always thought of myself as the best player on that floor when I stepped on it. And I still think that way of myself, not arrogantly, but so that I can always work toward excellence and see
yeah.
myself where I need to be and never shortcut myself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you definitely, like I said, you put up some real solid numbers, but also the longevity. How did you last, you know, 18 years? Man, that's an incredible feat in itself.
Well, I think that the thing that helped me outside of the grace of God was the one thing that most people would probably want to criticize me for was injuring my knee in the 10th year, playing out a pickup game out in Morgan Park at Ada Park in Morgan Park, Illinois. And a lot of people said that that was when my career actually started to go down. But for me, that injury gave me a grace and a perspective that I did not have prior to that. And that was that I could be as efficient as a role player as I was as being the man on the teams I was on before, because I knew what the requirement was. Coming off the bench to have that same mindset would help any team I played for. And in the end, it was that and the ability to lead that kept me active on these other teams. Coaches and general managers would literally call me and say, "We know more than once. We know you're at the end of your career and you could go for the championship, but we would love to have you come and help us lead these young men." And so that is a huge part of who I am, is the leadership part and being able to mentor, you know, the younger guys. I got to play, you know, for instance, with Gary Payton and Sean down in Seattle and play, you know, for that team, that city, and then go to New York and play with a bunch of veteran guys there, the Oakleys and the Buck Williams and all of those guys, Allen Houston. And also, you know, even playing with Allen Iverson and Derek Coleman in Philadelphia. And then I get to Golden State at the end of my career, and I get a chance to really be the leader of an organization, not just a team of players, and where the organization actually consulted me about the issues that dealt with the players. And those were the things that made that 18 years so much more fun. The last 7-8 years, I had more fun, and I was a more complete ball than I was the 10 years before that. So when I look back at it, it's a perspective thing. You know, sometimes I'll hear people say, "Well, he was just an average player." There's nothing average about a cat playing with the guys I played with and then being right in the flow in the midst of it for 10 straight years. You know, there's nothing average about that. Average is, you know, you average 10, 12, 15 points a game. But, you know, the first 9 or 10 years, I'm averaging over 20 points and 8 or 9 boards a game against the very guys who are creating the history, you know.
Well, you're creating it too. I mean, you're right there. You know, what was some of your early perceptions of Michael Jordan? And did you guys have any like one-on-one games back in the day? Because I imagine if you did, they would have been pretty good to watch.
No, we didn't do the one-on-one, but we played together in the pro-am at Chicago State for about 7 or 8 years. So we would be on the same team, and we either won or co-shared the MVP every year we won in that tournament, because our team wound up in the championship just about every year we were playing together. But my initial was I think the best way to put it was, I remember we were going over game plan playing the Bulls, I believe, in Chicago, and I remember Coach Nelson, Don Nelson, saying, "Okay," after everything had been done, he said, "Now I'm going to just warn you all, this kid is really, really good." He said, "So the thing that you have to guard against is that you don't get caught watching him instead of playing defense." And that was like one of the things I was like, he cannot be that good. You know, and this was before he and I met and started playing together in the pro-am. But he was every bit of that. I mean, he was so quick, and he got off his feet so quick, you know. And I remember at the top of the key, we were supposed to trap the pick and roll, and I jumped out too quick. He slid in between me and the other guy setting the trap, took one dribble into the lane and dunked on the whole team, and I said, "Okay, I get it." You know, I get it. You cannot watch this cat. You got to do your job, you know. And early on, we were at Milwaukee in position. We pretty much beat them the first few years we played them in any playoff type game, you know. And that was before I think Mike figured it out. But as a player and as a person, I mean, just, you know, good people. And I mean, can't even begin to speak to his talent and ability. And that's not blowing his horn. That's just out of respect. I mean, I didn't go there in any game against Mike and play anything less than my best game. And he was still Mike. You know, he still did what he did.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so he made you a believer then when you see him dunk all over everybody then, huh? Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could be on the highlight film whether you want to be or not, just because you just get caught standing and watching.
you're pretty close to the action. But you come in the league, you're automatically playing against Dr. J, Bird, Magic, you know, all these other greats too. But you didn't expect nothing like Jordan at that time, did you?
No, I think Mike. The stage was set for Mike for players like, you know, by players like who were high flyers like Julius Erving, and there were a lot of cats that actually could get off the floor like him, but they just didn't have the ingenuity and the creativity that he had with the ball. The closest thing to him was Dr. J, or vice versa, depending on how you look at it. But Mike just took it to another level. You know, and he was the reason why the game really sped the way it did initially. And all the rest of the players, including myself, that played, were beneficiaries of it. Because it was a global perspective to the NBA that they had not had prior to that group that came in with Mike. I mean, we were gradually getting there with the Birds and the Magic, Isaiah and Mark, that group that came in around 80, 81 or so. You know, when they came in, the NBA was pretty much in the same place as it is now. It was redeveloping into something other than what it was. And with that group coming in and then our group coming in 82, 83, you know, it just began to, you know, gradually change and form it to something different. And I think that this NBA basketball that we're watching now will develop as well. I think it's trying to find itself.
No. It's a whole different style of play nowadays than when you came up. The three ball is obviously very, very important now more than ever, it seems. But also, I mean, the calls. I mean, you guys would literally knock the crap out of each other, so to speak. And nowadays, people, that there's a lot of, there's a new thing called the art of flopping and acting. You know, I think a lot of guys are playing to those fouls to benefit themselves. Where, you know, back in the day, you guys would take hard hits, man.
Yeah, well, you flop if you want to, you're gonna pay for it.
Yeah.
Back then, but this is what we would consider, I think that the league made a precedented, you know, step into the direction it's in the 90s, coming into the early 2000s. And it was, they wanted everybody to be able to play the NBA game. Well, part of that means that you have to take out certain elements that everybody don't have a heart for. And part of that was the physicality. Everyone didn't have a heart for it, but it was what we always called the thing that brought the balance. If you played against someone that was quicker than you or that was a high jumper, athlete type, you know, being able to lay the wood on them, as we would call it, it brought balance. It equalized everything, you know, and it made it so that was how we all played the same game, you know, and it was not by taking that away, was by adding it to the game, you know, the hand checking, the forearms, you know, the bodying up. You know, nowadays, these cats, and this is their game and this is their time. So don't get me wrong in what I'm saying here. I'm not saying that this is not the way they should play. This is the way they should play because this is the way they've grown up learning how to play the game. If they had to play it the way we did, it would be destructive for them, you know. As it is, I think a lot more of them get injured than they should. And I think a lot of it has to do with all of this working out stuff that they do or don't do in the off-season, stuff that has nothing to do with a basketball court. And you have to be really careful because you're working muscles that you don't necessarily need for a basketball game, let alone an NBA season. You know, and so with all the things that they have and even the things that they do, more of than we ever did, generally speaking, that have to do with the entertainment side of basketball, you know, videos and, you know, traveling and doing and involved in a lot of things. I mean, I thought that one of the things that was really good about that era of the early 80s to the mid-90s was that these were cats that were professionals. We studied the game. We studied the history of the game. We studied each other as players. We knew what a person could do in our sleep. We knew what his strengths were. If he was a shooter, if he liked the two dribbles to the left and up or one dribble to the right and drive. You know, if he was a power player, we knew if he was a left shoulder guy or a right shoulder guy. I mean, we knew things about players and we knew things about teams, and whether they changed teams or not, it didn't matter. It didn't change those things that were or made them who they were. And I think that's a big difference in this NBA. There's so much hype and so little chemistry to the point where people actually sat down and, I mean, we would confer with each other on the same team about players. Cause if you, for instance, play for a Don Nelson coach team and you were a three guy, small forward, you had to be available. You had to be aware of what the three man was doing, the four man and the five. But on Don Nelson's team, you had to be aware of the 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. You had to know all the players, all of their weakness, all their tendencies. You had to be prepared to defend, too, because we were the first team to literally play small ball in Milwaukee. You know, Paul Pressey was the point forward in the offense at about 6'5", 6'6". And literally, I think that the style that the NBA plays now is conducive to the coaching style that Don Nelson came up with back then in the 80s with Milwaukee. And then with Golden State when he got there with the Golden State Warriors. But this is the game that the NBA plays now. It's just draw and kick. That's all. You find shooters. Shooters not available. And then there's the responsibility of the person who is the shooter that doesn't have the shot to drive the ball at the defense, kick it to the open man. Same game.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, definitely. One more basketball question for you, Terry. We were just talking about, you know, injuries nowadays. Man, Derrick Rose, I thought he was on his way to becoming one of the best ever. And it's good to see him get his legs back now, but after all those injuries, what do you think of his career? Like, what do you think would have happened if he would have been injury-free? Do you think he would have maybe got a title or two?
Yeah. I mean, in this NBA, Derek still is believe injuries or not, he's still a great player, and would have been because he still has the tools, you know, to do what he needs to do on the floor, and his quickness, his jumping ability, his smarts at getting to the rim, and anticipation on defense. I mean, this stuff still works. He still got it. Normally, for someone his size, the little guys, if you have those knee injuries or the type of injuries he's had, you lose your quickness, but he hasn't. He still has his. It may not be as explosive, but that's all relative because it implies that he has to be the Derrick Rose he was when he came in the league to be successful, and he's being successful without being that Derrick Rose.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I do think he would have won some championships, and I think that's the thing about life, though, that you never know how parity will find its way or its place, but it always does. And in sports, quite often it can be something tragic like a Kobe. This thing with Kobe had happened while he was playing. It would have turned the balance of everything in the league at that time, but it happened in his retirement. But Derrick Rose's injuries took place, for instance, during his career, so... And it has upset the balance because he's a great player.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. Man, like I said at the beginning of the show, you're a man of many talents. Very musically inclined. We're going to go to a track to close out the interview at the end. But before we do that, I want to know when you got your love for music and when did you start taking it serious to the next level?
And I'd always loved music. I was singing. My mom would tell me I'd be singing in the bathroom. She'd tell me to shut up before I wake the whole neighborhood up. And that was before I could really hold a tune. I just really enjoyed music. But traveling with in the NBA, I started traveling with a keyboard and laptop and taught myself how to read and write music because I could hear it. I just couldn't play it. And started learning chords and scales and, you know, just training myself for hours at a time in the hotel room. And then I started writing music for Black Entertainment Television for their TV shows in the late 80s. And that's when I started to make money doing it. And then I started, you know, songwriting. I've been in the business since 84, 85. And now I'm doing, you know, stuff, commercials, Coca-Cola, Pizza Hut, different things. So, but my love for music is par with the fact that I enjoy creativity and I see it in everything around me. And I started as a poet at 16, and in the poetry is just changing the fabric of how you write things into songwriting form. And so I'm a storyteller as well. So as a writer, I continue to elaborate more efficiently when I look at things poetically, and then create the song form, and then writing books, screenplays, and different things. All of those fall in line with it. So to answer your question more clearly, music has always been a part of my life, but never more than when I got to sing my own stuff.
No. So it's something that, you know, it sounds like something that was just in you from the jump, and, you know, developed into something very real.
Yeah, you grow into it.
Yeah,
with opportunity,
you know,
you grow into it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And was there any point, you know what I'm saying, during your NBA career I want to cut an album, I want to take a break, maybe go on tour, or was this something that you just wanted to put off until after your career was done? Did it just work out that way, or...?
No, I've always been real strategic. I never thought in terms of that I had to give up one career to have the other, because I learned pretty early, you know, you have to be real flexible with a lot of things to be successful, because you don't know which one is going to really work for you. It may be working now, but it may not work tomorrow, so you have to have other things that you can do. And so musically, I took the time, you know, under the radar to build relationships and work with other people, you know, and figure out how to be the best me I could be. The basketball thing was paying all the bills, you know, so it gave me the leverage to be able to sit behind other really prominent producers, Bill Maxwell out of L.A., Percy Beatty out of Chicago, and a lot of other people that I worked with, that people in the industry would know their names, that taught me, you know. And as I said, I'm a sponge. I pick up really quickly. So I was taking the time to just, again, be the best me I could be by learning from these folk and getting out there and learning how to perform. I mean, singing is one thing, but being able to garner the attention of a large group of people in an area, it takes time, because you have to have the confidence in yourself that what you're doing, what you're singing, what you're playing is something they are going to want to hear. And so you have to live up to it before you get to the area where you're out there in front of these people. You have to believe in yourself. And, you know, for me, one of the first big shows I did was with a group called Frankie Beverly and Maze. And, initially, when I came to them and we were talking about opening up for them, they were like, well, you can't bring a band and you can't have background singers, but you can bring a keyboard. And I thought, you know, well, why? And then I thought about it and I said, okay, I get it. You know, you want me to prove to you that I can be on this stage with you and that I can carry myself professionally. So I went out. And the first show was out in southern Georgia, somewhere, outdoor concert. And, you know, I'm out there with a keyboard just singing ballads. And that was the beginning for me. I realized not only I could do it, but that I could get better at it by doing it more. And so I did about four or five shows with them and started doing shows with other people in the IRE and different artists around the country. And bigger, you know, big groups, small groups, and then I would sometimes get the headline myself.
Yeah. That's great, man. That's it's great how you, you know, the message, you know, you never have all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. But it was great how you were able to, you know what I'm saying, navigate both careers and continue to do so in music now. Do you have any albums in the works or anything coming out that we can look forward to?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a new project called, what is this project? Don't let me forget what I entitled. I've been working with two titles for it, but it's another love project. I call them love and romance projects, and it's actually my fifth project, my fifth CD. The Love is a Journey, or The Journey of Love is what I'm contemplating as the title for it. And it's just, you know, talking about love from the beginning when, you know, you just, you know, may have in your youthful place, you know, you get involved and it's all just momentary stuff. It's all emotional stuff, from that form to love, to in love, to what is real love, which is, you know, to me, the epitome of what love is. It's finally finding yourself to a place where you got real and true love, which is unconditional and able to, you know, withstand most of the things that we go through. This is not the kind of love that is for romantics, because this love hurts. This love, you compromise and you believe in the person you're in relationship with no matter what happens with them. You know, you love them through it, they love you through your mess, and together you all grow old together. And I believe that's what used to happen with our parents.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, Terry, it's been real good talking to you. And I got a song here. This one's from 07, I believe, Marvin's Vibe, paying homage, you know what I'm saying, to, I believe, the late, great Marvin Gaye, if I'm not mistaken. Could you break down this song for me?
Well, Marvin, you know, I'm a Marvin Gaye fan, and I love this style of music. I loved his rhythmic parts of his music, because the rhythm of Marvin Gaye is as elaborate as today's hip-hop, you know, and I believe that before hip-hop was, there was Marvin Gaye putting together all these percussion backgrounds and regular drums and the things he did with the guitars, and I'd always loved the fact that he could arrange the way he did vocally and also musically, and put together these unusual arrangements, and then brought them out vocally. So I'd always been a fan, you know, from the day of watching him on television with my father, and listening to them in the backyard when they were playing cards, and they would have him blasting, and the Al Greens and all of those guys. So I grew up listening to Marvin Gaye, and many of my tones come out like his, and not on purpose, but I do enjoy his music. So I wrote this Marvin's Vibe as my celebration of my love for his music.
Definitely. Thanks again, Terry. If people want to check out your music, man, I'm going to give you the floor, brother. It's all yours.
You can find the music on iTunes under my name, Terry Cummings. There's I think the song you have is from Finally, TC Finally, which is, you know, to me, I think is my best project. It was the first one or two I did. And then there's L3, which is Live, Love, and Laugh. It's a lifestyle project, old school music. And then Black Love is a duet project. So they're all out there under Terry Cummings. You can find them on the iTunes, and anywhere you can find digital music, you can find it. Amazon.com, everywhere.
And that's what's up. That's what's up. Thanks again, Terry. I appreciate you. And
no
problem. I'd love to talk to you again in the future. This is Terry Cummings, Marvin's Vibe.
Can't you feel me? It's all I ever wanted, and it's all I ever wanted from you, baby.